A new documentary set in Rockford has won recognition at Sundance. It's now coming to Hulu, and director Bing Liu says you'll discover that the three young men featured are more complicated than we usually see on film.
It's not just like good person, good behavior, bad behavior. It's so tied into just the whole melange of feelings, the way that we make mistakes and grow. I mean, it's all part of it.
We'll talk about the film Minding the Gap. Also, how a Bloomington reporter came across the writings of a 6th century monk.
And somebody gave me this book, and I opened the Rule of St. Benedict and thought, what the heck is this?
Judy Valente joins us to talk about her new book, How to Live. Plus, the Perseid meteor shower will light up the sky with hundreds of meteors this weekend. We're talking with astronomer Dave Leake about everything you'll need to know. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up on the program this hour, we're going to find out about the meteor shower that's happening this weekend. We'll tell you where to look in the sky and when. And we speak with author Judy Valente about how wisdom from the 6th century can apply today. But first, there's an Illinois-based documentary that's getting lots of notice at film festivals around the world, including Sundance, where it won a special jury award. It's called Minding the Gap, and it's the story of three young skateboarders in Rockford, of their lives and the family they formed skating that helped them cope with abuse, death, and domestic violence.
Take one.
I'm making this film because I saw myself in your story.
I always felt like I didn't fit in with my family.
My parents ran this very controlling house. I ran away a lot.
Skateboarding is more of a family than my family.
If you're in central Illinois, Minding the Gap is actually screening at the Art Theater this evening in Champaign. For everyone else, it's on Hulu beginning on August 17th and will be in some theaters around Illinois as well. The guy behind the camera is Chicago-based producer and director Bing Liu. He's with us now from our studios at Northwestern University in Evanston. Hi, Bing. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So, Bing, I know you're behind the camera, but this is very much your story, too. I wanted to just to start by asking, where did you first meet the other two guys in the film?
When I was a sophomore or junior in high school, that was when the first public skate park opened up in Rockford, Illinois. So I went there, and one of the guys who's one of the main characters is Zach. He's a couple years younger than me, and he went to a different high school. But that's where I met him, and he was a really good skateboarder, so I filmed him as part of the, you know, part of the wider community of skateboarders that I was filming. We didn't hang out that much outside of the skate park, and after a few years I left town. But when I came back to Rockford to make the film, you know, I reconnected with him because he was about to become a father himself. And then with Kier, he's much younger. He's 7 or 8 years younger than me. And so I caught him, you know, as a little kid at the skate park on video a couple times, but I didn't really get to know him that well until I came back to make the film.
And when did you start skateboarding? When you were in middle school?
Yeah, I think I was like 12 or 13.
And I've never skateboarded, but there are these beautiful scenes of the guys skateboarding together down the street and around the skate park. It looks like a flock of birds flying. Is that how it feels to skateboard, like flying?
Yeah, it feels, you know, I was just talking about this with someone today. You know, it's actually much more like ballet or dancing than it is like something, you know, aggressive, that which is the way that I think sometimes it gets portrayed.
And how did you shoot those scenes? Because there's a lot of scenes of you following the guys. Are you on a skateboard as well?
Most of the time I'm running on foot. I'd been working, as you know, in the camera department on movies and TV shows for a long time, and I worked with a lot of Steadicam operators, and I saw that as, you know, a great way to capture skateboarding. So I just used it, sort of a poor man's Steadicam called the Glide Cam. I was able to run behind them. So yeah, I really wanted to capture a fresh way of, I really wanted to shoot skateboarding in a way that translated, you know, the sort of emotional, like human side of it, rather than this focus on the tricks. And so I trained for a year or two to really get to the point where I was intuitive using the Glide Cam, running on foot to follow skateboarding.
You trained for a year before you started shooting?
Yeah, I mean, when I say train, I mean, you know, I was just experimenting with shooting skateboarding, like outside of doing Minding the Gap. with this glide cam. So, you know, the first few months, it was pretty rocky, but I eventually got better and better at it. And so by the time I shot Mine in the Gap, you know, I felt really comfortable with that tool.
So there is, to the point that you made about emotion, there's this really delicate, I think very respectful balance that you achieve in a way I haven't often seen between these subjects who are your friends, but also maintaining both their story and your story. Was that something you thought a lot about?
I think it started when I was growing up. You know, I felt like I was a pseudo-therapist for a lot of my friends. It's just sort of what helped me get through my childhood. And so by the time I dug into Zach and Kiara's lives, you know, it felt pretty natural.
And so I think when we're thinking about this, there's a lot of this story where there's a lot of different things, both when you're talking about you, but also with Zach, and you mentioned before fatherhood. I think fatherhood's a really important part of this story. And there are scenes of the guys at the skate park holding Zach's baby and taking care of him. And I feel like we don't often get to see the perspective of really young fathers like we do with teenage moms. Is that part of why you wanted to include that?
I mean, when I first started the project, I really wanted to look at intergenerational growth. And, you know, I felt like there was a lot happening with, you know, young men either modeling their fathers or, you know, going against what their fathers represented if the relationship wasn't healthy. So that was something I really wanted to dig into. And that's partly why, you know, in documentary, it's all about access and casting. That's often what makes for a great film. And so, you know, Zach and Keir were people that I found after a year of traveling around the country, looking for people to follow. And Zach just really, you know, his charisma just really screams off the screen. You really want to watch him. But also, he was about to become a father, and that was not something I'd found with other skateboarders I was looking at.
Some of the really wrenching scenes revolve around Kier and the death of his father and how hard it was for him to handle. Kier says at one point that taking part in this documentary with you was like free therapy. Was that true for you as well?
Not in making the film. I mean, for me, you know, I was a one-man band for most of the production besides this one scene where I hired a sound person and a camera person to film me filming. So for me, it was like, you know, I was just caught up in the nitty gritty of making the film. You know, what do I need to film next? You know, when, you know, I have to have this rough cut ready for this feedback screening, you know, in a few months, let me focus on that. You know, where's Kier going to be at on this day when I have time to go out to Rockford? So I was very much caught up in the making of the film. And there wasn't anybody pressing back on me in the way that I was pressing on Zach and Kier to really try to dig into the past and what it meant.
Mm. There is this threat of abuse. And as you're talking about sort of the difficult stories, there's abuse by fathers and stepfathers. And it also, I think it's very interesting how this cuts across all the racial lines of the film, whether it's African-American or Asian or white. When we're thinking about that part of the story, how hard was that something you were looking for in particular, or is that something that came out as you were filming?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was really the point of making the film. I mean, the skateboarding, I mean, if you add up the numbers, it's probably only like 10 or 15 minutes of actual skateboarding in the film. It's really a coming of age film that really looks at violence in the home and where it comes from and, you know, how it affects boys who grow up. So skateboarding always felt like the sugar that was, you know, added to the spoonful of medicine. So that's, it was pretty, you know, it was just sort of finding a way to get at it in a way that I hadn't seen before.
And there's a connection that you, a point that you make, you talk about statistics and you talk about statistics in Rockford, and you mentioned the role that domestic violence plays in violent crime statistics. Was that also another way for you to be, for us to be thinking about domestic violence?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I feel like domestic violence as a subject, even hearing the word, can really conjure up sort of, you know, media or studies or, you know, discussions in the classroom maybe that are really on the nose. And I feel like, you know, having experienced it and witnessed it myself personally, it's not really, it doesn't really quite get at the experience of living through it. You know, I think the experience of living through it is that it's just an aspect of your life as you grow up, and it's there, it's ever present, but it's not this dreary, dark thing all the time. I mean, you still have these moments of elation and joy. You still have, you know, these feelings of love and hope. And so, you know, I was trying to find a way to tackle the experience of domestic violence in a way that wasn't too on the nose, that just felt like this, you know, something in the ether of their lives. And so things like filming the billboards that are in the film, or things like including, you know, the couple snippets of statistics, were ways that I felt comfortable doing that.
I also think that there is this really, you mentioned it before, the scene where you confront your mom, and this is where you were saying you had hired someone, about the abuse that you suffered at the hands of her husband, your stepfather. And she says she wishes that she was stronger and she doesn't know what to say to you. And I wonder if you think part of what keeps the cycle of abuse going is when people don't talk about things.
Yeah, that's certainly the start of it. I mean, it's just brushed behind closed doors. That's a big factor. I think there's a lot of factors that figure into why the cycle keeps spinning. There's not a lot of, you know, common language that we have to be able to talk about it without, like, this, you know, shameful look down at the floor sort of feeling that glosses over those conversations. So,
well, and it's nuanced, as you said, right? Because it's really complicated, because these aren't relationships where it is all about the violence or the anger. And you see that through the relationships that are in the doc, the way that people relate to each other.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to complicate the narrative. I mean, it's not just like good person, bad person, good behavior, bad behavior. It's so tied into just the whole melange of feelings, the complicated situations that life brings up, you know, the way that we make mistakes and grow. I mean, it's all part of it.
My guest is producer, director Bing Liu, behind Minding the Gap. We're talking about this Rockford-based documentary that's won about 28 awards, actually, since it had its world premiere at Sundance. Bing, so you're from Beijing and you grew up in Rockford. How did you end up wanting to become a filmmaker?
I think it was just, you know, I get obsessed with stuff. My folks are from the southwest of China in Sichuan, and I was sort of shipped around a lot to different folks because my parents were going to school in different cities at the time. And then when we moved to the States, we actually moved to Alabama, and my mom and dad divorced, and I was just left home alone a lot. And I was 5. And then we moved to LA, and it was like more time sort of being a latchkey kid. So I escaped to my imagination a lot. I watched a lot of movies and played with a bunch of toys and, you know, got obsessed with certain things. I think skateboarding became an obsession when I first started doing it. And then when I first picked up a camera, I was 14, I became obsessed with that too. It became this way to create new realities. And then I went to school to become an English teacher, actually. I majored in literature. And then while I was in school, I just got a production assistant job. And little did I know, for the next 10 years, I would just be working as a freelance filmmaker.
This was produced with Kartemquin Films here. What was it like to also shoot this in Illinois and produce it here as well?
Felt really nice. I mean, I'd worked as a crew member on productions in New York and LA, and it's just, you know, such a different vibe on the coast. I think there's something very special about working in the Midwest. There's so much like cultural richness, and there's so much, I don't know. I mean, I feel like people are, there's something that just I really like about the Midwest. And it was really awesome working with Kartemquin because, you know, they're this award-winning production company that really feels more like a community than a company. I mean, they're housed in this old apartment that the founder bought in the 70s, you know, and if you end up editing in one of their edit suites, it's like, you know, you're sitting on a roller chair, and if you let go, your roller chair slowly starts just rolling towards a wall. I mean, it's just got that sort of character to it. And everybody that works there, you know, works there for the love. There's something really wholesome and nice about being a Midwest filmmaker.
And I wonder what it's like also now to be a Midwest filmmaker and have venues like Amazon or Netflix, or in your case, Hulu, to help produce these docs or films. Does that make it easier?
Well, Hulu didn't acquire it until after Sundance. But it definitely feels nice to have the audience reach that these platforms provide. I think it's, you know, I think in the 2000s, the film industry became a little bit more democratic with cheaper equipment. But now with streaming platforms, you know, there's a more democratic sort of audience reach as well. I'm really happy that Hulu, you know, liked the film enough to pick it up, and I'm really excited because they have a really young audience, and I'm already seeing like the comments flow in from the trailer.
So Hulu picked it up afterwards. Were you surprised by that?
You know, everything's been a surprise. Getting into Sundance has been a surprise. I mean, this has been a crazy, crazy ride.
Well, you can see Minding the Gap and see what this is all about. If you have Hulu, I said beginning on August 17th, if you are in Central Illinois, it's screening at the Art Theater tonight. There'll be other screenings throughout Illinois and the Midwest. We will have all of that information at our website. But right now I want to thank producer, director, Bing Liu for joining us to talk about Minding the Gap. Bing, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. How can wisdom from a 6th century saint apply to America 2018? That's the question that motivates my next guest, Judy Valente. You might recognize her name. She's a longtime reporter. Most recently, she's been with our partner station, WGLT, in Bloomington Normal. And her new book is called How to Live: What the Rule of St. Benedict Teaches Us About Happiness, Meaning, and Community. She's got lots of events in Illinois over the next few weeks to talk about this. Next week in Chicago, next weekend in Springfield. She'll be in Normal in September. But right now, she's with me at our Urbana studios at WILL. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
So I think many of us can agree that we need to spend more time listening to each other these days. What motivated you to, and I wonder what you learned from writing this book about listening?
Well, the first question I often get from people is, why should we care about something that was written in the 6th century? Well, St. Benedict, who is the founder of Western monasticism, lived in a time very similar to our own. It was a time when the wealth was concentrated among the few. People had lost faith in their political leaders and in traditional institutions. Great culture was under threat from outside forces. Sounds a lot like the nightly news today, but it was really Rome in the 6th century. And what he wanted to do was not so much flee from the world as to create a different kind of culture, a different kind of community, one that placed community over competition, consensus over conflict, simplicity over consumption, and quietude over the constant distractions that people have in their lives. And this became the monastic community, which remains with us today.
How did you first encounter this community?
Well, very interesting story. Someone handed me the Rule of St. Benedict. Oh, in the late 90s, early 2000s, I was transitioning back to the United States from living in London and working for the Wall Street Journal and wondering what did I want to do with the rest of my one wild and precious life, as Mary Oliver calls it. And somebody gave me this book, and I opened the Rule of Saint Benedict and thought, what the heck is this? And what happened after that was, after my first book came out, which was a book about touching the sacred through poetry, I gave a presentation at a Benedictine monastery in Atchison, Kansas, called Mount Saint Scholastica, a women's monastery. And there I encountered for the first time how the Rule of Saint Benedict is lived. First of all, I was impressed with the ease with which these sisters move through their days, the kind of peaceful hearts that they exhibited, and the warmth of that community.
And how long they lived.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, one of my favorite sisters died last year at 101, and she was not the oldest in the community. So you know that this life has something there. And I knew that kind of peacefulness that they had, I wanted more of in my own life. And I realized that everything that they do, from how they eat dinner to the times that they pray to the way that they interact in each other, is based on the Rule of Saint Benedict.
And now you're an oblate?
Yes.
What's that?
You're right. An oblate is a lay associate of a monastery. What we do is we try to live the Benedictine values in our day-to-day lives. We may be married or single. We may be widowed. We may be Catholic or not Catholic. That's very interesting. Many, many non-Catholics are Benedictine oblates. But we try to live the values, what we call the Benedictine values, which would be community, consensus, simplicity, and a very important word in the Rule of Saint Benedict, which I hope you'll ask me about, which is listening, because it's something that I don't think we're doing very much of in our culture and in our political discourse.
Well, and to that point about listening, you write in the book that you talk for a living. Your job, like mine, is to talk to people. Why do you think that we don't think about the fact that our job is really to listen to other people?
Well, our job is mainly to listen. And unfortunately, we've gotten to a place too much into a corner here in America where we're talking at and over each other and we're not listening to each other. Interestingly enough, the first word in the Rule of Saint Benedict is not pray or worship or even love. It's listen. And Saint Benedict asks us to take it a step further. He asks us to listen with the ear of the heart, which I think is a beautiful phrase. And that's something that I'm pretty concerned about right now in our culture, and which I need to do more and more of in my own life. More listening, less talking.
My guest is Judy Valente, and we're talking about her new book. It's called How to Live, What the Rule of Saint Benedict Teaches Us About Happiness, Meaning, and Community. And to that point about listening, I wonder if I can ask you about what he said about listening with an ear of the heart. What does that mean to you?
Well, I think it means that each person that comes into our lives brings something, whether we recognize it or not. For example, the idea of hospitality goes hand in hand in the Benedictine world, in the monastic world, with listening. And it's this idea that everyone that you encounter has some gift, which may at first appear hidden to you. And I think this is very relevant as we look at the whole discussion we're having about immigration and refugees in our country. This is a misconception that monasteries were a place that walled themselves off from the rest of the world. That's not completely true. The doors of the monasteries then and now remain open to guests. And there was always a position in the monastery called the porter. And the porter's job was to greet guests. And he was to say one of two things, either thanks be to God or your blessing please, whenever anyone knocked on the door. And I think those are such interesting greetings because they both say that you're expecting good from this encounter with the guest. And we've almost turned that around in our country today. We've almost act like anyone who wants to come here, who hasn't been here for 100 years, is somehow a threat. And that's completely contrary to the monastic value of hospitality and listening and caring for the other.
I think about how people are pretty angry these days. And there's a chapter where you write about the two different types of anger that we often have. And I wondered if I could ask you about that.
I think there is two different kinds of anger. And one is the anger that comes when we see an injustice. And you might call that a righteous anger. I know I feel that quite a bit as a journalist. You know, when I do stories about wage theft, for example, or our African-American and Hispanic citizens being pulled over at higher rates than our white citizens by the police, there are things that create righteous anger. There's a different kind of anger that occurs when our ego is wounded. And I'm guilty of that, too. But a lot of that type of anger is due to the fact that you somehow feel disrespected or dismissed. And that anger has to be looked at and examined through the lens of humility. And a lot of people confuse humility with humiliation. The humility in a monastic sense comes from the root word humus, which simply means of the earth, that we are all of this earth. We are all in this together. Humiliation is something totally different. That's a negative thing. There's an interesting concept that comes through in the Rule of St. Benedict where he's very willing to accept that people are going to mess up. Even people living in a monastery are going to mess up. What's important to St. Benedict is that we examine our faults, we fess up to our faults, we try to make amends, and that we're still lovable and worthy despite our faults. And I found that aspect of the rule to be quite revolutionary for him to be writing this in the 500s, because it relates to what we're seeing now in the justice system. We call it restorative justice, where you, instead of focusing on punishing juveniles, for example, in juvenile court, you try to get them to reform their ways, to make amends. St. Benedict talked about that in the 6th century.
Some of these things are being implemented today. They do seem very countercultural. The idea of humility, the idea of not judging other people. And there's something that you write about in the book where one of the nuns that you encounter, she says within their community, they can disagree and not see each other as a threat. Do you think you have to have community in order to do that?
One line in the rule that's really interesting where he says, be the first to show respect to the other, supporting with the greatest patience one another's weaknesses of body and behavior. We were talking about countercultural. That is the most like countercultural line to me in the whole rule, and the one that's the most necessary for what we're going through today in our public discourse. If you take anything away from monastic life, all the values away, you still have to keep community. That's the core of it. And what's really interesting is the way that they make decisions by consensus. And it gets to what you were saying about not thinking of the person you disagree with as a never-ending threat. And this is a model I think we can use in business and we could use in our families. Everybody gets the same information in a monastery. Every person from the most junior member of the community to the most senior gets to weigh in. And then they see where is the will of the community going. They look at that. And the people who were in the minority at that point have to say, well, what is it that I'm not seeing? And the people in the majority at that point say, well, how is it that we can reconcile what the minority view is? And then the leadership makes a decision. But here's what's so interesting and what I think we need so much in our society. Once the decision is made, everybody pulls in the same direction. Everybody agrees to try to make it work. Now, I'm a journalist. You're a journalist. We've covered so much on the Affordable Care Act, health care reform. Think about what would have happened in this country if we'd spent as much time trying to improve the act as we did trying to tear it apart. It's that kind of a thing where people in a community understand that the community is what's important and you have to move forward and work together.
I'm speaking with Judy Valenti about her book. And Judy, you spent quite a bit of time, you write about your experiences at the Abbey of Gethsemane in Kentucky. How did you first visit there?
Oh, I love the Abbey of Gethsemane outside of Louisville. It's a Trappist monastery. The Trappists are a form of Benedictine spirituality. They practice a stricter form. I went there for the 40th death anniversary of Thomas Merton. So the first time was 10 years ago. We're now going to celebrate in December the 50th death anniversary of Thomas Merton, the famous Trappist monk who wrote The Seven-Story Mountain and introduced a lot of lay people to the contemplative life. His idea was you don't have to live in a monastery to live a mindful and contemplative life. I happen to agree with that. And one of the main things you get when you go to this monastery, you walk through an arch into the monastic grounds, and it says God alone and silence is observed here. And the most important thing I got from my visits there was the importance of silence. We talked about how we talk for a living, but we also listen for a living. But silence is important. In the rule, Benedict says, even good words can be left unsaid at times out of esteem for silence. And when you look at it, words often get us into trouble. You know, especially if you're, you know, somebody with a quick temper, words can get you into a lot of trouble. And I learned at the monastery a very useful thing. Before you open your mouth to speak, ask yourself three questions. Is what I'm about to say true? Is it kind? And is it necessary? And I think that last one is the most interesting one. Is it necessary? Because there's so much talking that goes on that is utterly useless in our culture.
And when you say that, I wonder what you learned about silence, how you implement that now that you, when you're not in a monastery. Because I bet there are a lot of people who are listening who are thinking, that seems like a lot easier thing to do, to be in community and to build consensus and to have time for silence when you're living in a monastery.
It certainly is easier because the monastic day is broken up so that you have periods for study, periods for prayer, periods for rest. And that's harder to do when you live a really hectic life as a journalist, for example. But I think you have to be very intentional about it and build these pauses into your day. I always tell people you can pause and still be productive. I have a friend who sets her cell phone to go off, you know, every couple of hours. And in fact, she has a ringtone that sounds a lot like bells at a monastery. And that is her moment to pause. And why is this important? Because we need to let the mind reboot during our day. I was working for the Wall Street Journal in London for a few years, and I realized that I would come to work in the morning, and I had a lovely desk that overlooked St. Paul's Cathedral. And I would come to work in the morning, and then all of a sudden I would look up at some point during the day, and it would be dark outside. The day had passed, and I'd missed it. I was missing out on my own life. And, you know, I realized that I had to take pauses during my day. I had to take time out.
And now you take email Sabbaths?
Oh, that's another thing. I'm glad you brought that up. I really think it's important to take social media Sabbaths, cell phone Sabbaths, and email Sabbaths. I mean, I really think there's got to be some hours in your day in this, you know, 24/7 world that we're in. You have to have some hours where it's absolutely cut off. You know, I used to have colleagues, my colleagues at the Wall Street Journal, who would miss their kids' birthday parties and, you know, miss anniversaries and things. And you can't get those things back. So you've got to take pauses in your life.
And what have you learned from that silence and those pauses?
Well, you have to live with yourself. Silence really makes you accompany yourself in your journey on life. When you don't have the distractions of cell phone and email and social media, who's there but you and, you know, those of us who believe would say the divine. And it's often in those moments of silence that I have to come face to face with the things in my own life that I need to confront, things that I need to change in my own life. And I also sometimes get inspirations. All of a sudden, an answer that I've been struggling with. You know, I've been talking to my friends or my husband or other trusted mentors about. All of a sudden, in that silence, the answer comes.
That's a little bit of what Judy Valenti learned from St. Benedict. And her book is called How to Live, What the Rule of St. Benedict Teaches Us About Happiness, Meaning, and Community. As I mentioned, she's got lots of events across Illinois over the next few weeks talking about this book. We'll tweet out some links to where she's going to be speaking. But if you are around in Chicago, she's going to be speaking next week, next weekend in Springfield in September in the Bloomington Normal area. Judy, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Nyla.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Every year around this time, the meteor shower Perseids light up the summer sky, and at its peak, which is this weekend, observers can see upwards to 60 meters dart across the night sky every hour. If you're in the central Illinois area, you can catch the meteor shower at Griswold Conservation Area from 10 p.m. to midnight on Saturday. That's located in Blue Mound, just south of Decatur. But if you're in other parts of the state, no worries. We're joined now by Dave Leake, who is the director of the William M. Starkel Planetarium. He also teaches astronomy and physics at Parkland College in Champaign. I bet people are also going to be able to view at the planetarium this weekend, are they?
Well, believe it or not, the planetarium will not be the best place to do that. You want to get out where it's fairly dark. In fact, our local astronomy club here in Champaign County is going to be going to the Homer Lake Forest Preserve. So we'll be out there Saturday night. We're going to do a program at 8:30 and then see how many meteors we can see after that.
And welcome to the 21st, David. Thanks for being here.
And thank you for having me.
Can you tell us what's behind the name Perseid first?
Yes, I can. Really, to talk about meteor showers, you have to talk about comets. Because comets, you remember the story of Hansel and Gretel, how they went through the forest with their breadcrumbs?
Oh, right, yes.
And that's what comets do. As they zip around the sun, a lot of the ices will vaporize, but there's a lot of dust in comets, too. So they leave this trail of dust, just like Hansel and Gretel did, and instead of breadcrumbs. And if the Earth happens to run into that trail of dust, then we see a lot of that burning up in the atmosphere, and you have a meteor shower. So you can see a meteor really any night of the year. You just have to kind of be lucky and be looking in the right spot. But in a time when we have these meteor showers, you have a much greater chance. So the meteors are actually coming towards the Earth in parallel paths, but it looks like they're coming from a spot in the sky, one spot in the sky, and that happens to be the constellation of Perseus, which is in the fall sky. That's where the meteor shower gets its name. A great example I can give you is, don't really do this, but if you're standing in the middle of some straight railroad tracks, then in the distance it looks like they go back to a vanishing point. Where obviously they're not. The tracks are parallel, but it looks like they do. Well, it's the same thing with meteor showers.
And so these are actually remnants that are burning up as they encounter the Earth's atmosphere?
Yeah. They come through the Earth's atmosphere roughly 100,000 miles an hour, and then they slow down. And the way I like to do this in class is if you take just an aquarium and maybe throw a thumbtack in it. Well, the thumbtack's going really fast. When it hits the water, it slows down. Well, you have to do something with that energy, and what we do is it transfers the energy to the air, and the air actually glows. So you're not really seeing the little particle, because it's about the size of a pea or smaller, so you're not really seeing it burning up. You're seeing the air glowing in the trail.
And none of these remnants, do they all burn up before they get through the atmosphere?
Yeah, all the stuff from comets are pretty small. When you hear about meteorites, things that have come down and actually hit the Earth, it might look a little the same in the sky, but something a little bigger is probably coming from the asteroid belt.
We're talking about the Perseid meteor shower that's happening this weekend with David Leake. He's the director of the William M. Starkel Planetarium in Champaign, Urbana. This meteor shower, why does it only happen once a year then? It's because this comet only comes around once a year?
That's it. Yeah, that's when it's not so much the comet. In fact, the comet, the last time it was here was back in 1992. And it takes about 130 years to go around the sun. But again, going back to that Hansel and Gretel scenario, when it goes around, it leaves this dust trail. And that's what the Earth runs into. And so every year about this time, the Earth runs into the same dust trail. We do the same thing with Halley's Comet. Most people have heard of Halley's Comet, and we run into the trail, again, not the tail, but the trail of Halley's Comet twice a year, actually, in May and October.
So for people who have never seen a meteor shower, what does it look like? How would you describe it?
Well, you're really just outside looking at a hopefully dark sky. And the good thing about meteor showers is you don't need equipment. You don't need binoculars. You don't need a telescope. You need your two eyes. Maybe take a lawn chair. That would be good. Some mosquito spray. And you just want to set up out in the darkest sky you can and really just look up, and you'll see these swift streaks of light in the sky. Some are fainter, and some can be quite bright where they'll light up the ground.
Do they kind of look like shooting stars?
Well, and that's what a lot of kids like to call meteors or shooting stars. And we use the word meteors just because they're really not stars. They're, the little bits, the little dust grains. But some of them can look almost star-like as they fall through the sky.
But are shooting stars meteors?
Yes.
Always?
Yep.
Oh, okay. Well, that answered that question. But I wanted to ask you also about, you said the best place to see this would be outside. Mm-hmm. And so we have folks listening all over the state. First of all, I imagine the viewing, when we're talking about what we can see, is probably for North America, for this hemisphere.
Yes.
So this time of year, we can see this well in this hemisphere.
That's correct.
And then, will there be any differentiation between different parts of Illinois in what you can see?
Not really. Given these things are burning up about 60 miles up, I suppose what one might see in, say, the northern part of the country might be a little different in the southern part of the country, but it's not really one side being favored over the other. So really, you just need to find the darkest sky you can.
And I remember us talking during the eclipse. Do you have the same view no matter what part of the country you're in?
Yes, that's correct. It's not like there's a path like it was during the eclipse where you had to get to a center line or something. You just go out and with a lawn chair and check it out.
That said, if you're in a place that has a lot of lights, a lot of city lights, or light pollution, as some people like to call it now, how much can you see?
Just less. The brighter meteors you'll still be able to see, but the brighter the sky is, you won't be able to see a lot of the fainter ones. So the numbers get cut down considerably.
And where would you suggest people go then? Do you think forest preserves are a good place? If you're in a city, where's the best place? Where do you want to head out to?
You want to drive out into the country somewhere. If you know somebody out in the country, that's maybe the best thing. You don't want to camp out in a farmer's field and get somebody nervous and call the police. But depending on what city you live in, you ought to look for the local astronomy club. Again, ours is going to be at Homer Lake. But I know, like, Rockford has a very active astronomy club. Bloomington Normal has a very active astronomy club, the Twin City Amateur Astronomers. So look up the astronomy club and see if they're doing any meteor observing.
We will do that for you, and we will tweet out that information if you follow us at 21STShow. We'll also have it at our website at 21stShow.org. Speaking of light pollution, throughout Illinois, are there places where you think you can have pretty good unobstructed views when we're thinking about light pollution, when we're just generally thinking about sky viewing and star viewing?
Yeah, well, what's interesting is, and forgive me, I can't quote the URL to you, but they actually have light pollution maps of the country. So if you Googled that, I'm sure you could find it. And one of our club members actually went with a sky quality meter, which is a meter that points up and measures sky brightness, and went all around the county looking for the dark spots. And we actually have a good light pollution map of the county. So down near Homer, Sydney, there's a good spot, and the Middle Fork Forest Preserve that's east and a little north of Rantoul are really the two darkest spots in Champaign County.
And how big of a problem is this now?
We hope it's getting better. It is a problem in that cities are expanding. Cities all over the place are getting bigger and bigger. However, people are becoming more aware. If you look now at a lot of new constructions, all the parking lots are shielded lights, which means that the lights are shining downwards. We don't want people to think that you need to turn your lights off. That's not it. It's not these crazy astronomers are trying to get us all to shut our lights off. It's not it at all. The example I give all the time is, would you take your lawn sprinkler out to the end of your drive and water the street? And nobody would do that. It's a waste of water. But we do it with our lights all the time. We just sort of turn on a light without really giving a lot of thought to where the light is shining. You're paying for all that energy that's coming out of that light. And if it's shining up into the sky, it's a complete waste.
I'm speaking with Dave Leek. He's an astronomy and physics professor. He teaches at Parkland College. He's also the director of the William M. Starkle Planetarium. And Dave, you're actually working on the first dark sky park in Illinois.
Yeah, we're working with the Champaign County Forest Preserve to try to get dark sky park status for the Middle Fork Forest Preserve, which again is in northeastern Champaign County. We don't have a dark sky park in Illinois. There is a dark sky community up in the Chicago area, but no dark sky parks. If we can get this, we'll be on the same list as, say, Grand Canyon and Canyonlands and Arches. And it doesn't mean we're as dark, but it means that we value the dark sky as a resource and have put things into place to try to maintain that resource and done a lot of education. So I know the CU Astronomical Society has gone out to the Middle Fork. We go 2, 3, 4 times a year and do programs out there. In fact, the last time it was quite clear, and we had a lot of people show up. I think it was over 100 people showed up and looked through our telescopes. But people get out of their cars and they're just amazed because, especially when we have students that come from Chicago, they've never seen the Milky Way before.
Mm. And I understand that there's a couple planets that you actually can view right now.
Yeah, it's a really good time for planets right now. The brightest thing in the west is Venus. And then if you kind of start turning towards the south, I guess that would be counterclockwise from above. The next brightest thing you're going to see is Jupiter. And then to the left of Jupiter will be Saturn. Now, there's a red bright star in there, too, so don't confuse the red star. But then Saturn, and then the brightest thing in the southeast right after sunset is Mars. And Mars was just as closest to us as it's been in 15 years.
And is that something you need a telescope to see?
You can see the planets, and they're going to look a lot like stars, but they won't twinkle. And you can see those with just your eyes, but to see any detail on them, you do need a telescope.
And getting back to the Perseid meteor shower, I understand mm-hmm. that this year the showers is expected to be especially bright because there's not that much light from the moon. Can you explain how that's working?
It's kind of the big trifecta is what I call it. Not only is it one of the best meteor showers of the year, but it occurs on a weekend, which is good, and it occurs during a new moon. We talked about the light pollution drowning out a lot of the fainter meteors, and the moon will do the same thing. If you have a bright, say, full moon in the sky, you're not going to see many meteors at all. But we have a new moon, which means the moon is in the same general area in the sky as the sun, and so we won't see the moon the entire night. So that's a real good thing.
And if it's cloudy or if it rains, we'll just have to kind of see how that goes.
Oh, bite your tongue. We're not going to talk about that. We're not going to talk about clouds.
All right. Let's hope that the trifecta is not ruined by the weather. I want to thank Dave Leake for being with me. He teaches astronomy and physics at Parkland College. He's also the director of the William M. Starkle Planetarium at Parkland. Lots of places this weekend. Dave, what's the best time for people to go out on Saturday?
Well, that's the one downside of meteor watching, probably. You can see meteors any time of the night, but the rates pick up after midnight. And the reason for that is that if you think about a race car that's driving on a track and some mosquitoes, a whole swarm of mosquitoes kind of wander out onto the track. Well, think about where all those mosquitoes are going to end up, and they're going to end up on the front windshield. The only mosquito that hits the back windshield is one that's going faster than the car, kind of a, you know, kamikaze mosquito or something. But this Earth does the same thing. If after midnight we're on the same side of the Earth as that front windshield, we're plowing into the meteor stream. So before midnight, you're seeing any bits of dust that are going faster than the Earth is, and there are some. So you will still see some, but the rates seem to pick up after midnight. That's the one downside.
Midnight, when you say the rates pick up, how many do you think people can see? If conditions are great, how many do you think people...
If conditions are great, we're hoping for one or two a minute. I know back in 2016, they had a little outburst for the Perseids where they saw 120 an hour. I don't know if we'll see that many this time, but that's the fun thing about meteor watching is we can make predictions, but we don't really know.
All right.
So hopefully one per minute. Like you may see... none for a couple of minutes, then you may see four or five in a row.
That's Dave Leake, the director of the William M. Starkle Planetarium. Dave, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
That's it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21ST Show. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website. 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Panlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.